"Is that the last of it, Robert?" the Earl of Corus asked, watching as Robert's sea blanket finished closing and strapping up one final trunk.
"It is, my lord."
Sea Blanket rested one hand on the trunk as he turned to meet his employer's gaze, and although his tone was as matter-of-fact as ever, it would have taken someone far stupider and less observant than Philip Osgood to miss the relief in his valet's eyes.
"In that case, let's get them down to Hornet."
Cora smiled without a great deal of humor, but with a degree of relief which was even greater than Sea Blanket's.
"Father Hollis is expecting us, and I'd prefer not to disappoint him by being late."
"No, my lord," Sea Blanket agreed fervently. "I'll have them aboard within the hour."
"Good, Robert, good."
Corus patted his valet on the shoulder, then turned and walked across to stand gazing out through his window across the city of Zion.
"God, I can't wait to get back across the lake."
He shook his head.
"I thought on my way here that things couldn't get a whole hell of a lot worse. How little did I know."
His own meetings with Zomson Trenair and Jaspar Clinton had been bad enough. He'd come to the conclusion he'd actually underestimated Clinton's cynicism and ruthlessness. Frankly, he wouldn't have believed Clinton could be even more ruthless and calculating than he'd initially assumed, but he'd learned better. And if he might somehow have managed to cling to any tiny fragment of an illusion in that regard, Clinton's vicious purge of any opposition within the vicarate would have disabused him of it. Corus folded his hands behind him, gripping them tightly together. He'd never actually met Samuel or Howard Wilson, but he had met Vicar Kyan Hyson of the Harching Hysons, and anyone less like a ravening heretic who molested little girls would have been impossible to imagine. Yet those were the crimes of which Hyson stood accused, and to which, according to the shocked and stunned inquisitors, he had already confessed. There was no doubt in Corus's mind that Hyson's true crime, just like the true crime of everyone else who had been arrested or killed resisting arrest, or simply died under mysterious circumstances in the last 3 5 days, had been to oppose, or threaten to oppose, or even to remotely seem to oppose, the group of four. There did appear to be at least some genuine evidence of clandestine activities on Hyson's part. Corus had to admit that much. But even though he'd been unable to establish anything like the sort of intelligence network he could have put together elsewhere under more favorable circumstances, he'd managed to get at least a few feelers threaded through the temple and the city. And those feelers all agreed, quietly, cautiously, in whispers designed to avoid anyone else's attention, that any secret activities on the part of Hyson and the rest of the vicars and prelates who'd been labeled the Carisian Circle had been directed at the group of four and the rampant abuses within the clergy, not designed to somehow betray the temple and God into the hands of the apostate.
"Of course that's what they were doing," the Earl thought coldly. "The fools. Oh, the fools. How could they?"
He shook his head.
"Be fair to them, Philip. Before this whole business with Carus exploded in everyone's face, opposing Clinton was only insanely risky, not automatically suicidal. They didn't just decide to start doing this the day before yesterday, and Clinton hasn't been licking his chops in anticipation of this moment because he genuinely thinks they had any immediate plans to stage some sort of coup inside the vicarate either. This is just a case of his killing two wyverns with a single stone, and enjoying the hell out of it when he does it."
He closed his eyes for a moment, leaning his forehead against the icy window pane, in a brief silent prayer for the men who were undoubtedly, at that very moment, undergoing the tortures of the damned at the Inquisition's hands. The men who were going to face the same hideous death Eric Dinis had already faced. Unless Clinton could come up with ones which were still worse. and the men whose families had been arrested right along with them.
"You've got to get back to Talkeera,"
he told himself flatly, almost desperately.
"You've got to get back to Iris and Divan."
He shook his head, eyes still closed.
"If Clinton's willing to do this, willing to arrest 1 in 10 of the Vicarate itself and condemn them to death just to secure his own position, then it's for damn sure he'll throw Divan away in a heartbeat."
Corus shook his head. The only member of the group of four who seemed to give a genuine damn about Divan's well-being had been Robert Ducerne. He'd met with the treasurer only twice, yet he hadn't had to meet with him even once. Those meetings, officially to discuss Divan's financial needs and the proper amount of the church subsidy to support his court in exile, had been arranged from Ducerne's side, and it was obvious to Corus that it had been the vicar himself who had done the arranging specifically, so that he and Corus might meet face to face. The Earl appreciated that, although he'd been careful about showing it. He was almost certain, but only almost, unfortunately, that Ducerne's concern for Divan was sincere. It fitted with his own earlier assessments of Ducerne's attitudes, at any rate, and the sorrow hiding behind the vicar's eyes had looked genuine enough. There'd been no way to be positive about that, however, and it had always been possible Ducerne was simply testing Corus's suitability as the group of four's tool in a rather more subtle fashion than would have occurred to Clinton. Walking the tightrope between doing his best for Divan's future interests and maintaining his own persona as a properly corruptible henchman hadn't been the easiest thing Corus had ever done, although a lifelong career as a spy had helped. But however real or feigned Ducerne's concern might have been, there was no doubt at all where the rest of the group of four stood. Corus's present ability to follow the news from Coruscant was limited, especially at such a vast distance, yet his sources here in the temple, fragmentary though they were, all suggested things weren't going outstandingly well for the temple's interests in Coruscant. The tone of his more recent conversations with Trinaire suggested the same thing as well. Although the Chancellor had done his best to downplay any concern he might personally be feeling, the situation in the capital in particular seemed to be tilting towards a genuine accommodation with Caleb and Charlian, or with the Church of Caris at least. And the moment Jaspar Clinton decided the Coruscantian fire needed another kick, that another dastardly Carisian assassination might tilt Manchir back the other way,
"I've got to get back to Talkeera." "She's actually pulled it off,"
Abraham Jevons thought.
"My God, she's actually pulled it off."
Or at least she had so far, he reminded himself. It was still possible the wheels would come off, but as he'd watched the caravan of massive, snow lizard-drawn sleighs sliding over the icy high road, it had become obvious that his initial concerns about Angelic Ponda's safety had been just a trifle premature. In many respects, the timing on Angelic's escape from Zion could hardly have been better. This late in the winter, with the roads and ground frozen iron hard, it was actually easier to move heavy loads overland over snow and ice aboard properly designed sleighs, assuming the availability of draft animals like Safeholdian snow lizards, than to move them aboard wheeled wagons during the fall or early winter, and much easier than it would be once the spring thaw began in another month or so. In fact, in some ways, it was easier even than it would have been in summer. And it was a damn good thing that was true, too. Despite the existence of scores of warehouses, granaries, and supply depots in Zion, by this point in the winter, the city was always in desperate need of resupply. Regular freight shipments were always bound into Zion and the temple, except for the month or so each year when weather completely isolated the city. Now that the freeze had set hard enough and deep enough, the delivery tempo had been steadily increasing for several 5 days, despite the winter storms which had recently howled their way across the northern temple lands. And just as movement into the city had picked up, so had movement out of the city, including a large convoy from Brewster freight haulers. There was a fair amount of general merchandise in it, including several hundred bottles of fine brandies and whiskies. Personally, Jevons found the Chisomian whiskies superior to anything coming out of Zion, but there was no denying the prestige of the Zion and Temple distilleries. Whether they were actually the finest spirits available or not, which they definitely were not, in his humble opinion, they commanded exorbitant prices purely on the strength of their labels. In addition to the spirits, however, there were also crates of books from Zion's publishing houses, somewhere around a 250,000 marks worth of religious art, and a consignment of fine jewelry, which was probably at least equally valuable. Most of the other freight consisted of relatively low-weight, though often quite bulky, items, like an impressive assortment of tapestries, fine carpets, and woven luxury goods from the church's flocks of sheep and mountain lizards. But even many of those were high-value commodities, and security was always a significant concern in cases like that, which explained why so many of Brewster freight haulers' sleighs were built around large, sturdy, thickly planked cargo boxes. They were almost as large, in some cases, as freight containers Nemu Albin had seen loaded aboard starships during her naval career. And of course, they had been locked and securely sealed by gimlet-eyed customs agents before they ever departed Zion. Every item aboard them had been meticulously checked, according to the paperwork at least. And in fact, they had been checked just as thoroughly as they always were, which was to say the customs agents had examined the manifests, found Jaspar Clinton's bailiff listed as one of the shippers, and promptly sealed the sleigh's cargo boxes just as officially as anyone could possibly have asked. In their doubtless commendable zeal to speed Vicar Jaspar's property on its way, however, a few small irregularities appeared to have escaped their alert attention. Specifically, it would seem they'd failed to note that six of the larger sleighs were equipped, in addition to the carefully locked and sealed hatches through which their valuable cargoes had been loaded, with small, oddly unobtrusive belly hatches as well. Cargo doors which, for some unknown but undoubtedly sound reason, had been designed so that they could be reached only by someone who actually got down on his hands and knees, or for most adults on his belly, and crawled under the sleighs between the runners. The hatches through which over 50 fugitives from the Inquisition had entered those sleighs. It wasn't the most convenient mode of travel ever invented, but the sleighs' cargo boxes were thick-walled and weather-tight. The passenger-carrying cubbies hidden away inside them were large enough to accommodate mattresses and bedrolls and allow at least some movement, and they were surrounded and thoroughly concealed by rugs and tapestries, by piles of expensive Zion-made blankets and other big-ticket textiles. In fact, the people hidden away inside those cubbyholes were warmer than anyone else in the entire convoy. And once they were at least a couple of days away from Zion, they'd been allowed to leave their hiding places after the sleighs had halted for the night and mingle unobtrusively, very unobtrusively, with the Brewster drovers and wagoneers, who, alas, were not unaccustomed to seeing the occasional unmanifested face turn up on journeys such as this one. The trip would not be brief. In fact, the sleighs would follow the southern shore of Xingwu's Passage all the way from Zion to the shores of the Icewind Sea. Along the way, they would drop off at least some of their cargo in various towns and small cities strung out along the passage. But the real reason for taking that particular route was that it avoided the extraordinarily difficult terrain of the Mountains of Light. To help them do that, Mother Church, the Temple Lands, and the Republic of Siddharmark had cooperated over the centuries to build and maintain the high road which paralleled the passage. When the seagoing route was navigable, grass grew, literally, on the high road. When winter closed Xingwu's passage, the high road came into its own once more. By now, Angelic and her refugees were almost a third of the way to Siddharmark and the galleons, which would ultimately carry them to Telesburg and, hopefully, safety. Unless something went dreadfully wrong, they should be aboard ship within 2 months, and in Telesburg 7 or 8 5 days after that. By the end of June at the latest, I can't believe how easy she's made all this look. Jevons shook his head wonderingly as he crossed to the sleigh assigned to Mistress Francine Talbot, who, oddly enough, didn't look a thing like dainty, fragile, lovely Angelic Panda. No, Mistress Talbot was pleasant-looking enough, but she was also, clearly, the experienced, professional, sensibly dressed senior clerk Bruce Darren Sons had assigned to ride herd on this particular convoy's more valuable items. He rapped lightly on the sleigh's side door, then opened it and climbed the short boarding step when a voice invited him to do so.
"Good morning, Ibrahim," Mistress Talbot said with a smile. "What can I do for you today?"
"Actually, I've just come to bid you farewell," he replied.
She sat back in her seat at the small built-in desk, eyebrows rising, and he shrugged.
"As nearly as I can tell, you've gotten away clean," he said. "We could both be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And now that I've figured out your evacuation route, I can arrange to have some of Sage and Merlin's other friends keep an eye out for you."
He chuckled suddenly.
"After all, the Mountains of Light are the traditional training grounds for Sagens, aren't they?"
"So I've heard," she acknowledged,
then turned her floor-mounted swivel chair to the side and stood.
"I'll miss you, you know," she said,
taking the 2 steps required to cross her tiny mobile office and hold out her hand. This time he simply took it in both of his, squeezing it without kissing it, and she smiled.
"Will I be seeing you again?"
There was an odd note in her voice, he thought, an almost whimsical one, or wistful, perhaps. They'd known one another for less than a month, yet he was confident she'd realized as well as he that they were kindred souls.
"Another of those capable, uppity females," he reflected. "She and Charlian are going to get along like a house on fire. I can already see that. And I suppose I still come under that capable, uppity female label, too. In a somewhat convoluted manner of speaking, at least."
"Oh, I think you can count on that," he said out loud. "I've been told I'm a bit like a bad habit or a cold."
Her eyebrows rose higher, and he chuckled.
"Almost impossible to get rid of, once you've got me, I mean."
"Good."
She smiled and squeezed his hand back.
"I'll look forward to it."
"So will I," he assured her. "So will I."
18. Royal Palace, City of Trangier, Kingdom of Taro. King Gorgia III was in a foul mood. That had become, unfortunately, common over the last couple of years. Since the effectively total destruction of his fleet at the Battle of Rock Point, which had occurred almost precisely 2 years ago, as a matter of fact, if anyone had been marking his calendar to keep track. Gorgia didn't need to mark any calendars, but he'd definitely been keeping track. He'd been rather strongly motivated in that regard. At the moment, he stood gazing northwest out of his palace window, up the length of Thol Bay. 700 plus miles, Thol Bay reached from the city of Trangier
to Cape Thole and North Head, and, beyond that, the Gulf of Taro and the continent of East Haven. It was a magnificent stretch of salt water. It might be a bit shallow in places, its shoals a bit treacherous here and there, but overall it offered Tangier splendid access to the seas of the world, and the broad sweep of the city's wharves and warehouses was ample proof of the way in which the world's commerce had taken advantage of that access.
"Once upon a time," he thought grumpily.
He ran a hand over his kerchief, the traditional bright, colorful headwear of the Kingdom of Taro, and his foul mood deepened as he contemplated the absence of merchant shipping in that anchorage. The dearth of lighters plying between those non-existent merchant vessels and the city's wharves. The peculiar paucity of longshoremen and stevedores who'd once been employed, loading and unloading the cargoes which no longer filled those extensive warehouses. There was a reason for those absences, for that dearth, a reason which had something to do with the squadron of the Imperial Carisian Navy, no more than a handful of schooners supported by a single division of galleons, who'd taken up residence in Thole Bay, who'd had the sheer effrontery to actually set up their own anchorage in Holm Reach, well inside the bay's protective headlands, to send parties of seamen and marines ashore on Hourglass Island to plant and tend garden plots to provide their crews with fresh vegetables and salads. Somehow, for some reason Gorgia really didn't understand himself, that particular bit of Carisian brashness was especially infuriating. Perhaps, he'd occasionally thought, because he knew he'd brought it on himself. Mostly, at least, he still didn't see any way he could have said no to the offer.
"Not that you tried all that hard," he thought moodily now. "It seemed like such a good idea at the time, after all, which probably should have reminded you that things which seem too good to be true usually are, which was the reason Edmund argued against it from the outset."
The king grimaced as he recalled the diplomatic language in which Edmund Rustman, the Baron of Stonekeep, had attempted to restrain his own enthusiastic response to the bait which had been trolled in front of him. Gorgia's grimace deepened at the memory.
"I'd like to say it was all the church's fault, well, the group of fours anyway, and I suppose it was. But be honest, Gorgia. Edmund was dead right to try to moderate your enthusiasm, wasn't he? And you wouldn't listen, would you? They'd figured out exactly the right lever to pull in your case, hadn't they? You resented the hell out of the treaty, never mind the fact that it had its good sides as well, and you figured it was a chance to get your own back. And why did you think that way? Because you were a frigging idiot, that's why."
His grimace turned briefly into something like a snarl. Then it vanished, and he folded his hands behind himself, turned his back on the window, and crossed to the lavishly carved, not quite a throne chair, at the head of the brilliantly polished table. Summer sunlight from the window bounced off the imperfect mirror of the tabletop, throwing a spot of brightness on the council chamber's ceiling as he seated himself. The chair had been custom-built for his father, who'd been considerably taller and stockier than the slender, dark-haired Gorgia. The king favored his mother, physically at least, far more closely than he ever had his father, and he contemplated, not for the first time, the desirability of having a new one, one that made him look less like a child sitting in his parents' chair, commissioned. From the viewpoint of political psychology, of his ability to dominate meetings, the notion probably had much to recommend it, but the chair was almost sinfully comfortable. Besides, as a boy, then Prince Gorgia had spent quite a few hours sitting in his father's lap in this very chair. Those memories came back to him every time he sat in it, and especially over the last couple of years when his infant son, Roland, had been cuddled in his own lap.
"I wonder if he'll ever get to sit in it," the king thought moodily. "For that matter,
I wonder how much longer I'll get to sit in it.
They were both valid questions, and he didn't much care for the answers which tended to suggest themselves. Caleb of Caris had obvious reasons to want his blood, given the way Taro had betrayed the terms of their treaty. Simply adding Taro's fleet to the onslaught on Caris would have been bad enough, but Gorja hadn't stopped there, oh no. He'd followed Chancellor Trenaire's orders like a good little henchman, and lied to King Harald as well. Promised to honor his treaty obligations even as he was ordering Baron Whiteford to rendezvous with the Royal Dolaran Navy. The fact that Harald had been subsequently killed only made bad worse in that respect, although Gorja could at least reflect that none of his ships had been involved in the Battle of Darkos Sound. So he could argue that he personally hadn't contributed to Harald's death. Not that he expected that particular fine distinction to cut much ice with Harald's son. Unfortunately, Caleb wasn't the only person Gorja had to worry about. In fact, if Caleb had been his only concern, he'd have been considerably happier. But despite his very best efforts, the group of four seemed to feel he'd proved just a tad inept as a traitor, scoundrel, and general all-around backstabber. And to be honest, Gorja couldn't really disagree. He'd tried, he really had, yet someone in his court had leaked the Knights of the Temple Lands' plans to Harald, thus neatly undoing all of his own efforts in that direction. He still didn't know who'd done that, and not for lack of trying to find out. The ruthless, meticulous investigation had turned up all sorts of interesting things, from minor peccadilloes to bribery to extortion, on the parts of his nobles and officials. That had undoubtedly been useful, he thought. At least he'd hammered his nobility and bureaucrats so hard, the survivors were deeply dedicated to doing their jobs efficiently, and above all honestly, in a fashion Taro hadn't seen in decades. Probably in generations, really. Yet all his efforts had failed to unearth a single clue as to how the group of four's plans had reached Caris. Gorja had respectfully pointed out in his correspondence with Vicar Jason that his investigations had been personally assisted by Bishop Executor Turner and by Father Franklin Sumir, his intendant. For that matter, the full resources of the Inquisition here in Taro had been thrown into the task, and none of that effort had found even a trace of whoever had done the leaking. Perhaps, the king had suggested as diplomatically as possible, that indicated the security failure hadn't, in fact, occurred in Taro, after all? As far as Gorja could tell, Felix Garber, the kingdom's archbishop in far-distant Zion, supported his argument. Garber certainly had plenty of personal reasons to do so, at any rate. And officially, Chancellor Trenaire had cleared Gorja himself of any wrongdoing. It had been a grudging clearance, however. Gorja couldn't say that surprised him. For that matter, if he'd been in the Chancellor's cassock, he probably wouldn't have gone even that far. Because the damning truth was that the only royal court which could have leaked the information upon which Harald of Caris had acted so decisively was Gorja's own. There simply hadn't been time for the information to reach Caris from anywhere else speedily enough. Given that, he supposed, and especially in light of how devastating the Carizian ambush off Armageddon Reef had been, it wasn't surprising it had taken Trenaire over a year to go even as far as he had. During that year, unfortunately, Gorja and his entire kingdom had languished under Mother Church's disapproval. His shipyards had been deliberately and pointedly excluded from the church's original building program, for example. Which, given the fact that virtually the entire Royal Taroisian Navy had been destroyed, had made Gorja even more unhappy than he might have been otherwise. He'd needed new ships,
and almost as badly as he'd needed them, he'd needed access to the rivers of gold the church had poured into its new galley fleet. As a matter of fact, he'd needed the money even more badly, given the ruinous economic consequences his ill-advised decision to betray Karras had produced. At the time, everything had seemed extremely simple. The group of four had decreed Karras's destruction, and so Karras was going to be destroyed. The possibility that the church might fail of its purpose had never crossed his mind. And why should it have? No one, well, no one outside of Harald of Karras, perhaps, could have seriously entertained such a preposterous notion for a moment. And with Karras destroyed, Taro would almost inevitably have absorbed a comfortable chunk of the one-time Carisian maritime monopoly. That rosy road to the future, unfortunately, had encountered a minor pothole when Karras declined to perish on schedule. Not only had the pestiferous kingdom been gauche enough to survive, but its navy had emerged even more powerful than it had ever been, and a plague of Carisian privateers had amused itself, eliminating all the rest of the world's merchant shipping for fun and profit. Taro's merchant marine had come in for special and loving attention, and the privateers' depredations had been followed up by coastal raids by Carisian marines under the cover of Imperial Carisian Navy galleons. And then, to make bad worse, Empress Charlian had ordered the official ICN blockade of Thole Bay. Rather than improving its position, the Taroisian merchant marine had become extinct, with catastrophic consequences for the kingdom's revenues. Even that wasn't the worst of it, however, because there was still a substantial flow of Carisian goods into Taro, although Gorgia had been careful to ensure that he had no official knowledge of that state of affairs. None of it was legal, of course. Karras had declared a blockade, and Mother Church, or at least the office of the Grand Inquisitor, had officially closed all of the world's ports to Carisian merchant ships. Obviously, therefore, no one could possibly be delivering the products of Carisian manufactories to a law-abiding kingdom like Taro. Unfortunately, Taro needed those products. No one in the kingdom could produce them in sufficient quantity or cheaply enough to meet the needs of Gorgia's subjects. And the last thing he needed was the resentment of subjects who couldn't provide their families the necessities of life because their king was worrying about pettifogging legal technicalities about closed ports and embargoed goods. And so he winked at the bustling clandestine commerce of the smugglers landing cargoes all along the southeastern coast of the Duchy of Trangier. But in many ways, the smuggling only made things worse. None of the smugglers were especially interested in charity. They demanded and got cold, hard cash for their wares, which meant Taro's limited and dwindling supply of hard currency was steadily hemorrhaging its way into the very pockets of the kingdom's enemies. The temple's refusal to extend its largesse to Gorgia had been a particularly painful blow under those circumstances.
"And things aren't a lot better now," he thought moodily. "Not that I can blame all of it on the group of four."
After Trenair officially absolved Gorgia of having betrayed the group of four's plans, the kingdom had finally been grudgingly included in the church's building plans. Probably even that had happened only because of how much revision those plans required once that incomparable military genius, Elaine Maguire, finally figured out that they should have been building galleons all along. Gavin Martin, the Baron of White Ford, had made that point rather strongly in his own initial report on the Armageddon Reef campaign. That report had been summarily ignored, of course. In fact, there'd been some pointed comment about defeated, incompetent admirals offering up excuses for their own failures. There was a certain bitter satisfaction in seeing White Ford vindicated, although Gorgia wasn't especially surprised,
when no one in Zion bothered to make that vindication official. And there was no doubt that the change in the church's plans, with the sudden need for even more shipyard capacity, had quite a lot to do with the fact that it had finally begun placing orders even in Taro. The grudging nature of Taro's inclusion was evident in the number of ships the kingdom had been assigned, however. Of the 240-plus new-build war galleons the church had ordered laid down, only 22 had been ordered from Taro, despite the fact that Trangier alone could have built half again that many. And the kingdom had been directed to convert less than 20 merchant galleons for naval purposes as well. Even the Desnarian Empire, which had never really had a navy before, had been assigned twice as many vessels, and paid the absurdly inflated prices the Desnarian yards had demanded. For that matter, the church had helped build their damned yards in the first place. Unfortunately, Gorgia couldn't pretend the church's decision to throw such a small piece of the pie in Taro's direction had been motivated solely by pique. The unhappy truth was that Taro was the only one of the church's building sites which wasn't connected to the mainland. Carizian privateers and cruisers had stung, hampered, and pillaged the coastal shipping carrying naval materials to the mainland yards badly enough. Their ability to dominate the Taro Channel between Taro and Sidarmark's Windmore province had put a virtual stranglehold on any effort to get those same materials to Trangier. Timbers could be cut domestically and dragged, if slowly and laboriously, overland to the shipyards. Hulls could be built. Sails could even be woven, and rigging could be set up. But no foundry in Taro had the expertise to produce naval artillery. All of the Royal Taroisian Navy's pre-war guns had come from Carizian foundries, which, for some peculiar reason, seemed moderately disinclined to deliver their wares to Trangier just at the moment. In many ways, Karis had been ironmaster to the world, for not even Sidarmark or the Harchong Empire had truly rivaled the output of her foundries. Not only had it been far cheaper to buy ironwork, including artillery, from Karis, but the expertise, as well as the foundry's physical plant, had been overwhelmingly concentrated in Karis as well. So even if Gorgia had possessed unlimited financial resources, which he most definitely did not, he had no experienced foundry masters who knew how to build cannon that didn't blow up the second or third time they were fired. A couple of small domestic foundries were making some progress in acquiring the needed skills, but it was frustratingly difficult and agonizingly slow.
And as Whiteford's pointed out, it's probably not totally unreasonable for crews to be just a tad leery of guns that have demonstrated such a pronounced tendency to kill or mangle their gunners, he thought disgustedly.
Well, perhaps this morning's meeting might usher in some improvement in that situation. It was unlikely, but a man could always hope. All right, he said as he settled himself more comfortably into the cushions of his father's chair, turning his head to look at the Chamberlain standing just inside the council chamber's door.
Tell Sir Rick he may come in now.
Of course, Your Majesty.
The Chamberlain bowed, opened the door, and stepped out into the hallway. A moment later, a stout, stocky man somewhere in his late 60s entered the chamber. He was mostly bald, and his remaining fringe of hair had gone entirely gray, but his eyebrows remained bushy and black, and his full beard was only lightly streaked with silver. His eyes were a very dark gray, and his nose was decidedly crooked, having been broken in a shipboard brawl in his youth. He also walked with a pronounced limp, courtesy of the fall from aloft, which had ended his career at sea and sent him into an apprenticeship in a Carizian foundry. In the decades since, Sir Rick Farman had become one of the wealthier foundry masters of Taro, until the majority of his wealth, like that of quite a few other Taroisian subjects, had been largely destroyed as a consequence of the Carisian blockade. Pharman was still much better off than most of those other subjects of Gorsha's. In fact, he was in a position to recoup much of what he'd lost, because he was also one of the handful of people in the entire kingdom who had any experience at all in casting and boring artillery.
"Your Majesty," the foundry owner said, bowing respectfully.
"Serik."
Gorsha acknowledged the courtesy with a nod, then waved for the older man to straighten up once more. Pharman obeyed the gesture, and Gorsha leaned back in his oversized chair.
"Tell me," the king said, "to what do I owe the pleasure of your company this morning?"
"First, your Majesty, let me thank you for agreeing to see me. I realize I made the request for an audience on rather short notice."
Gorgia's left hand made a waving away motion, and Pharman dipped his head slightly to acknowledge the king's graciousness.
"Second, your Majesty," Pharman continued, "I've come to invite you to join Baron Whiteford at the foundry in a couple of days, Tuesday, I think, for the proof firing of our latest attempt to produce a satisfactory 36-pounder.
The Iron Master's lips twitched a bit sourly.
"I hope this one will go a little better than the last. Having said that, though, I'm not about to let you or Baron Whiteford get anywhere near the thing when it's actually loaded, your Majesty."
"I'm sure Queen Mael will appreciate that,"
Gorsha murmured with a slight whimsical smile.
"I always try to stay on the Queen's good side, your Majesty,"
Pharman assured him, and there was a gleam of answering humor in his gray eyes.
"A wise decision, trust me," Gorsha replied. Then he cocked his head. "And were those your only reasons for asking to see me this morning?"
His tone was still pleasant, yet it carried a distinct edge of hardness as well. Not anger, but an indication that he was fairly certain those weren't the only reasons for Farman's request, and a suggestion the foundry owner get on to his other, and presumably more important, motivations.
"No, Your Highness,"
Pharman acknowledged, and his tone had shifted a bit as well. In fact, to Gorsha's surprise, it had taken on a hint of tentativeness. That wasn't the exact word the king was looking for, and he knew it, but it came closer to anything else he could think of. The foundry owner paused. One might almost have said he hesitated for an instant, then shrugged ever so slightly.
"As I'm sure you know, Your Majesty," he went on then a bit obliquely, "I was originally trained in Carus. Over the years I've done quite a bit of business with Carisian manufactories as well. Or perhaps I should say that I did do quite a bit of business with them before the present unpleasantness."
He paused again, watching the king's expression, and Gorsha nodded.
"Of course I'm aware of all that, Sir Rick," he said just a little impatiently. "And you're scarcely alone in having had financial relationships, or for that matter personal relationships, with Carus. I don't imagine there's anyone involved in our current building programs who didn't, if that's what you're concerned about."
"I'm not concerned about it precisely, Your Majesty, but it does have a certain bearing on the reason I asked to see you this morning."
Pharman looked at the king levelly.
"It happens, Your Majesty, that a letter was recently delivered to me by someone who, alas, I suspect acquired it from a Carisian smuggler."
Gorgia's eyebrows rose, and Pharman coughed delicately into a raised hand.
"I don't say he acquired it directly from a smuggler, Your Majesty," he said then. "I only say I believe that was how the letter in question originally entered the kingdom. It was, however, addressed to me, which, as I'm sure Your Majesty will appreciate, caused me quite a bit of anxiety."
He shrugged again.
"My first thought was to deliver it directly to Father Franklin, although I will readily confess to Your Majesty that I wasn't at all happy about the prospect of directing the Inquisition's attention to the man who had handed me the letter."
"Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, Sir Rick,"
Gorsha thought dryly.
and not simply because you didn't want to get the other fellow, whoever he may be, into trouble. Oh, I'll do you the courtesy of believing you thought about that, but I'm certain keeping yourself out of the Inquisition's sights wasn't exactly a minor factor in your decision not to go pestering the Intendant as well.
But Farman wasn't quite finished yet. Nor was I happy about the prospect of directing the Inquisition's attention to the addressee of the letter which was enclosed in the one to me, the older man went on. Because that addressee, Your Majesty, was you.
Gorgia's eyes went wide and he leaned forward in his chair. I beg your pardon, he said in a very careful tone, and Farman smiled humorlessly.
That was rather my own reaction, Your Majesty. I opened my own letter only because I've known the man who sent it to me for so long, and because, frankly, I wanted to judge the extent to which it might compromise me in the Inquisition's eyes.
He made the admission calmly.
So far as I was aware, I'd done or said nothing which might have created a legitimate problem for me, but one can never be too careful about things like that in times like these.
He held the king's gaze unflinchingly, and Gorgia nodded slowly as the other man's implications sank in. The king could think of quite a few possible consequences of the Inquisition's discovering that anyone in Karras was addressing correspondence directly to him as well. Oddly enough, not one of those consequences would have been pleasant.
Once I found the enclosure, Farman continued, I seriously considered burning both letters. On more mature consideration, however, I realized I had no way of knowing if additional letters would be sent if this one didn't produce whatever outcome its sender had in mind. The idea of having an unknown number of Carisian letters addressed to me, and quite possibly to Your Majesty, floating around the kingdom didn't appeal to me. And frankly, the thought that the letter sender might attempt to reach you through a different channel, one which could end up bringing all of this to the Inquisition's notice after all, was even less appealing.
The foundry owner hadn't mentioned the probability that a different channel wouldn't have known the initial letter had come by way of Farman, which would have meant, presumably, that the other man wouldn't have been implicated, so far as the Inquisition knew, in the effort to set up some sort of clandestine communication with the king. Farman was far too astute not to have thought of that, and the fact that he hadn't chosen to say a word about it suggested many things to King Gorgia of Taro. "Should I assume, Sir Rick," he said carefully, after a trickle of seconds, "that you've brought that letter to me?"
I have, Your Majesty.
Farman bowed gravely, then extracted a large envelope from inside his tunic. Gorgia held out his hand when he saw it, and Farman limped around the table to lay it in his palm. But he paused before he handed it to his king.
Your Majesty, I've brought you both letters, he said, looking Gorgia in the eye. Obviously, I haven't opened the one addressed to you. I have no idea what it contains. If you choose to place all of this in the Inquisition's hands, I will cooperate in any way they or you require. Indeed, if you wish it, I'll take both of them to Father Franklin immediately, without ever mentioning this meeting.
I appreciate the generosity of your offer, Sir Rick, Gorgia replied, and he meant it. Nonetheless, as yourself, I believe it behooves me to see what this letter contains first. He showed a flash of white teeth, and his dark eyes glinted with genuine, if sardonic, humor. I can think of quite a few ways in which a letter could be crafted to create all manner of suspicion in someone's mind.
I considered that, Your Majesty, Farman acknowledged. At the same time, though, it occurred to me that if the idea was to plant false information, false suspicion, in the mind of the Inquisition, there were probably simpler and more reliable ways for Earl Grey Harbor or Baron Wave Thunder to accidentally allow their correspondence to fall into the Inquisition's hands.
Gorgia's eyes narrowed thoughtfully. There'd been no need for Farman to offer that last observation, and the king wondered why he had.
"Is that simply your way of suggesting that you think whatever this damned thing says is genuine? Or is it your way of suggesting that I ought to read it, and possibly give some serious thought to whatever it does say?"
He considered asking the question out loud, but only briefly. Either way, it really didn't matter. Except that, again either way, the foundry owner obviously did think he should read it.
"That's an excellent point," he said instead, and waggled the fingers of his outstretched hand very slightly.
Farman took the hint and laid the envelope in his palm. Gorgia let it lie there for a moment while he gazed down at it, feeling its weight, wondering what it said. Then he looked back up at Farman.
"Sirik, I'm well aware that bringing this to me was no easy decision. I appreciate your courage in doing so, and the frankness of your explanation. And for that matter, the wisdom of your analysis. Now, however, I think it would be best for you to return to your home while I examine this and think about it."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Farman began to back away from the table, avoiding the social solecism of turning his back upon his monarch. But Gorgia raised the index finger of his free hand, and the foundry owner paused.
"If it should happen, I decide the Inquisition needs to be informed about this, Sirik," the king said quietly. "I'll have word sent to you first, before I contact Father Franklin."
He saw Farman's face tighten slightly.
"I believe I owe you that courtesy, and whatever happens, I promise you that I won't forget your service in bringing it to me."
He emphasized the final pronoun very slightly, but deliberately, and Farman nodded.
"Thank you, Your Majesty. And now, with Your Majesty's permission..."
He gestured in the door's direction, and Gorgia nodded.
"By all means, Sirik," he agreed,
then watched while the foundry owner eased out of the council chamber and the door closed quietly behind him. The King of Tarot gazed at that closed door for the better part of 2 minutes. Then, finally, he laid the envelope on the table in front of him, opened it, and extracted its contents. He paid no immediate attention to the cover letter to Farman. Instead, he slowly unfolded the second envelope which had been enclosed in the first one, and his eyes widened as he saw the handwriting. He paused for just a moment, then flattened it on the table, holding it down for a moment with both hands, the way a man might restrain a small, unknown animal he wasn't certain wasn't going to bite.
"Well, I don't suppose that's a surprise,"
a corner of his brain reflected, as he studied the handwritten address.
"Or maybe it is. I'm sure he has a secretary somewhere he could trust with almost any correspondence. On the other hand, I imagined he could be fairly confident this would be one way to get my attention."
The king surprised himself with a snort of humor.
"Not that his rather dramatic way of getting it delivered didn't already take care of that."
King Gorgia shook his head, looking down at the envelope an extraordinarily busy and powerful man had addressed himself. There was no question in the king's mind that the man who'd done that had expected his addressee to recognize his handwriting. No, it had truly come from him. Now it only remained to see exactly what Regis Yowance, the Earl of Grey Harbor, and, effectively, the first counselor of the Carisian Empire, had to say to him. March, Year of God, 894. 1. HMS Dancer, 56, off the Thermon Peninsula, Southern Ocean. It was cool on deck, despite the bright sunlight, as the brisk easterly wind pushed HMS Dancer steadily westward in a wind hum of rigging and the wash and bubble of water around the hull. The galleon was on very nearly her best point of sailing, with the wind coming in just abaft the starboard quarter, and with all sail set to the royals, she was making almost 10 knots. That was a very respectable turn of speed for any galleon, even one only 2 months out of port. Of course, like every galleon in the Imperial Carisian Navy, Dancer was copper-sheathed below the waterline. It protected her from both the borers, which all too often devoured a ship's timbers without anyone noticing, until her bottom fell out, that was, and from the weed, which killed her speed as well. Nothing could completely stop a ship's bottom from growing steadily fouler, but Dancer's copper gave her a tremendous advantage. It was going to make her faster than most ships she might meet, even as far away from home as the Gulf of Dolar. Still, she could have done a bit better than her present speed if she'd been sailing by herself. Admiral Sir Gwilym Manthier thought as he paced steadily back and forth along the railed walkway, which stretched the full width of her stern. Ships sailing in company were always slower than they might have been sailing alone, because every sailing vessel was unique. Each had her own best point of sail. Even sister ships from the same dockyard, as alike as two peas to the human eye, took wave and wind differently, made their best speeds under slightly different conditions. A captain who knew his ship as well as Captain Rafe McGale knew Dancer could wring the very best performance out of his command in any given wind and sea, but when ships sailed in company, they were limited to the best speed of the slowest vessel under whatever conditions currently applied. That thought was one which had been largely academic when Manthier had commanded HMS Dreadnought, then Prince Caleb's flagship. Despite the fact that Dreadnought had been a fleet flagship, Manthier's responsibilities hadn't included deciding what that fleet was going to do next, or worrying about how long it was going to take all of its ships to get from one point to another. Of course, he wasn't a mere flag captain any longer. He'd lost Dreadnought at Darkos Sound, a memory which still brought him intense pain, and not simply because of how much he loved that ship. He'd lost her, in the end, because he deliberately rammed her into a Coruscantian galley under all the sail she could carry. Even though she'd struck bows on, she'd been traveling too fast at the moment of impact, and he'd split her seams wide open. He'd managed to stave in a good 20 feet of her hull planking as well, inflicting far too much damage below the waterline for her crew to save her, desperately though they'd tried. He'd known well before she struck that he was going to do potentially fatal damage, too. But that wasn't the reason the memory hurt so much, no. No, it hurt so much because, even so, he'd been too late. Because, despite all he and his crew had been able to do, and he knew without doubt that they'd done everything humanly possible, they'd been 10 minutes too late to save their king's life. Gwilym Manthier would have sent a dozen galleons to the bottom in return for those 10 minutes. He realized he'd stopped pacing, that he was standing with his hands on the sternwalk rail, staring back across Dancer's wake. He looked out over the vast expanse of the Southern Ocean and gave himself a shake. The only person in the world who blamed him for being too late was himself, and he knew that too. His knighthood and his promotion from captain to admiral would have been proof enough of that, even without his current assignment. His was the most distant of all of Karras's far-flung squadrons. He was 2 months out from the great naval base at Lock Island, with 18 war galleons, 6 schooners, and no less than 30 transports, and wind and weather had favored him quite unreasonably. Indeed, he was the better part of 2 5-days ahead of his originally projected passage time, some 100 miles south of the Theramin Peninsula, rounding up around the southern end of the continent of Howard to pass through the Gosset Passage between Westbreak Island and the western tip of the enormously larger island called the Barren Lands into the Harthian Sea. That put him 9,000 miles from Lock Island, but that was in a straight line, and ships couldn't just fly through the air.
To reach this point, Manthir's squadron had been forced to sail over 15,000 miles, and they still had almost 5,000 to go. At such a vast distance from any of his superiors, Manthir was entirely on his own, which was a pretty conclusive statement of his superior's trust in him and his judgment, however he looked at it. After all, he had only the resources aboard his own ships, plus whatever he could liberate, and no one to turn to for orders or directions. In some ways, that made him no different from the captain of any warship on independent duty. Ultimately, every captain in that situation was always on his own when it came to the decision point. And whatever that captain decided, someone else was likely to decide he'd been wrong and say so, loudly. But that was part of the price for commanding a king's, or now an emperor's, ship.
Still,
he thought, gazing out over that enormous spread of dark blue water.
I have to admit that I never really appreciated as a mere captain how much nastier the whole thing gets as a flag officer.
His lips twitched wryly. One thing he'd learned long ago was that the perspective was always different. As a midshipman, he'd thought captains were God and lieutenants were archangels. As a lieutenant, he'd started to recognize that captains were only masters after God, but they'd still been at least equal to the archangels in their godlike authority and power. As a captain, he'd come to recognize, fully recognize for the first time, the full crushing weight of the responsibilities a captain shouldered in return for his all-powerful authority at sea. But now that he was an admiral himself, he realized that, in many ways, flag officers had the worst of all worlds. For all their lordly authority, they commanded squadrons and fleets, not ships. They directed, they administered, they devised strategies, and the full weight of responsibility for success or failure rested upon them. But they were forced to rely on others to execute their plans, carry out their orders. They might even get to direct the movements of their squadrons up to the moment battle was actually joined, yet once the ships under their command finally came into action, they were spectators, passengers. For all their lordly power to direct the movement of other ships, they would never again command their own, and he hadn't realized just how much that was going to hurt.
Oh, stop it, Gwilym.
He chuckled harshly.
If that's the way you feel, you can always ask them to take the nice Admiral's streamer back. Or you could have asked them not to give it to you in the first place. There's a price for everything, and you learned that a long time before you got your captain's commission. Do you really think you could convince anyone, including yourself, that you don't want to be out here doing what you're doing?
Probably not, he reflected, and then, in response to a certain rumbling sensation from the direction of his stomach, pulled his watch from his pocket. No wonder he was feeling peckish. Lunchtime had arrived 10 minutes ago, and he had no doubt Captain McGale and the rest of his officers were already seated around the large table in his dining cabin, waiting for him.
Yet another proof rank has its privileges, he thought wryly, closing the watch.
He straightened and inhaled another deep lungful of the clean ocean smell.
They're all sitting there waiting for me while I stand here in lordly splendor and isolation. I wonder how much longer they'll be willing to give me before Donald comes ever so respectfully looking for me.
He had to admit that a tiny, nasty part of him was half tempted to wait and see how long it would take for Donald Rosman, his highly efficient flag lieutenant, to overcome his natural deference and oh so diplomatically remind his admiral that he had luncheon guests waiting for him. But it was only half a temptation. Maybe even only a quarter temptation, he reflected judiciously. No, it was at least a third of a temptation, he decided, which probably said less than complimentary things about his own nature. He grinned broadly and shook his head.
It's good to be the Admiral, Gwilym, he told himself. It might be a good idea not to let it go to your head, though. I think Admiral Lock Island said something in that general vein when he gave you your orders, didn't he? In his own inimitably diplomatic fashion, of course.
That thought transformed the grin into a deep, rolling laugh. He gave his head another shake, then turned and stepped through the windowed door from the stern walk into his day cabin.
2. Summit House Lodge, Province of Glacier Heart, Republic of Sidarmark.
Your Eminence, how long have I been your valet?
Jason Kinnear turned to look at Freedman Thomas speculatively. He knew that long-suffering tone entirely too well.
For quite some time, he said mildly, at which Thomas folded his arms and gave him a very stern look indeed.
At the moment, the Archbishop of Glacier Heart sat in front of a fire barely short of roaring. Summit House Lodge, the name some long-ago archbishop had bestowed upon his summer retreat, lay considerably higher up the mountain behind the city of Terrace than the city itself. The relatively modest lodge was also, despite the steep-pitched, snow-shedding roof all buildings required in these mountains, intended as a summer residence, a place for the archbishop and his favored guests to withdraw into rustic seclusion and relax. Kinnear suspected that at least one of his predecessors had also seen Summit House as a secluded venue for drunken parties and the occasional orgy, far enough away from his parishioners' disapproving eyes to avoid any official scandal. The fact that it had been viewed primarily as a summer residence, however, also meant that even though it was weathertight, it hadn't really been designed for occupancy in the coldest month of an East Haven winter. Despite the high-piled coal fire on the drawing room's hearth, the air temperature left much to be desired, which was why Kinnear wore a thick sweater over his heavy woolen winter-weight cassock. Despite which, he felt a certain sympathy for a ham hung up in an ice house.
For 43 years, Your Eminence, Thomas told him now. That's how long I've been your valet.
Really?
Kinnear canted his head to the side.
I do believe you're right. Odd. I thought it had been longer than that somehow.
Something glinted in Thomas's eyes, and his sternly set lips might have twitched ever so slightly. It was possible, at any rate.
Well, Your Eminence, saying your pardon and all, I hope you'll not take it the wrong way if I tell you that of all the addle-brained flights you've gotten up to. And yes, I do remember that party of yours when you near as nothing got tossed out of seminary. This one is the worst.
It's not as if I really have much choice at this point, Freedman,
Kinnear replied in a much more sober tone.
And I deeply regret having gotten you involved in all of this. But,
he shrugged, and Thomas snorted.
The way I recall it, Your Eminence, I was as enthusiastic about it as ever you were. I'd not go taking all the credit were I you.
No, that's fair enough, I suppose. But I'm the Archbishop around here. It's not right that you should suffer for my actions, or that you should be stuck up here with me, hoping whoever wrote that letter meant what he said.
And where else should I be? Thomas demanded. I've no more chick nor child than you do, Your Eminence, and you need someone to look after you. I've gotten into the habit of doing that.
He shrugged.
Look at it how you will. There's little point in regretting, and even less in trying to change what's done.
Well,
Kinnear smiled, feeling his eyes burn slightly.
If that's the way you feel, then why this sudden criticism of my plans?
Why, as to that, if it were to happen you had any plans to speak of, then I'd not have opened my mouth.
Somehow, Kinnear found that a bit difficult to believe.
As it happens, howsomsoever, as near as I can see, your plans consist of turning up in the middle of the night, in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of the winter, in naught but the clothes on your back, and hoping someone as you've never met and don't even know the name of will be waiting there for you. Would it be I've got that more or less straight, Your Eminence?
Actually, I think that's a fairly masterly summation, the Archbishop conceded.
And do you think all of that's a good idea, do you? Thomas demanded.
No, I simply think it's the best idea available to us, Kinnear replied. Why? Have you thought of a better one?
No, and it's not my business to be thinking of better ones either.
If Thomas had been fazed by Kinnear's challenge, he gave no sign of it. Besides, as both of them understood perfectly well, his was the duty to sound the voice of gloom and doom, not to suggest how his dismal prophecies might be evaded.
It's just that I was wishful of being certain I had all that straight in my head.
I'd say you do, Kinnear said judiciously.
Well, in that case, and seeing as how your mind's made up, I'd best see about finishing packing, hadn't I?
Much later, that afternoon, Jason Kinnear stood, gazing out of his summit house bedchamber window. This late in the day, especially here on the eastern side of Mount Terrace, the tallest peak of the Terrace Range, evening would already have been settling into night, even under the best of conditions. Under the current conditions, he could see very little beyond the flakes of hard-driven snow being blown through the feeble illumination of the window's own light. Wind howled around Summit House's eaves, and despite the fires on the hearths, his breath steamed. It would be an excellent night for freezing to death, he reflected. He turned back to survey the bedchamber in which he would not be sleeping tonight after all. He understood why his decision to make a retreat up here had dismayed Garth Gorja. Summit House's primitive facilities, its isolation, and the possibility of weather exactly like this night promised had been more than enough to make his secretary worry about his well-being. For that matter, Kinnear was forced to admit he shared some of Gorja's concerns. On the other hand, he knew something about Summit House which he doubted his secretary had even considered while he was thinking of things to worry about. There was no reason he should have thought about it, given how carefully Kinnear had kept the younger man ignorant of the worries crushing down upon him. And the very things which had made Gorja worry about Kinnear's spending a couple of 5 days up on the mountain had actively reassured Brian Teigman, who very definitely did not know about Summit House's special features. It was possible Bishop Executor Willis did know the aspect of Summit House which had made it so suitable to Kinnear's present purposes, despite the season and the weather. He'd served the last Archbishop of Glacier Heart for over 8 years, even before Kinnear had been confirmed as Archbishop, and he'd used the residence frequently himself during the hottest 5 days of the summer. As such, it was possible he'd made the same discovery Kinnear had. Of course, even if he had, it probably wouldn't have occurred to him to worry about it. Probably. Kinnear didn't know if the Bishop Executor had been actively recruited by the Inquisition. He doubted it, yet he was also aware that he wanted to doubt it because of how much he liked Willis Hamilton. The Bishop Executor was hard-working, dedicated to the well-being of the Archbishopric and its people, and remarkably restrained in the graft he skimmed. He wasn't immune to the peculation which had infected the church, but that would have been a bit much to expect. In fact, it was expected he would find the odd way to slip a few less-than-legal marks into his purse. However much it might sadden the Archbishop to admit it, that practice had become so accepted that the Treasury allowed for it when establishing a Bishop Executor's official remuneration. And the fact that Hamilton was part of that system was the only real criticism of him Kinnear could have levied.
Unfortunately, he'd never evinced any particular awareness of, or zeal to attack, the far greater and uglier corruption at the heart of the temple. It wasn't that he approved of it. Kinnear was certain of that much, at least. But Willis Hamilton was a provincial bishop executor assigned to one of the poorest archbishoprics in all of East Haven. He was never going to find himself serving in Zion or the temple, whatever happened. And so he'd resolutely set his focus on his world and his responsibilities in it, leaving the concerns of the greater and more powerful to the greater and more powerful. Kinnear couldn't really fault him for that, but it was the reason he'd never approached the bishop-executor about his own activities, which meant he could hardly have asked Hamilton whether or not he did know Kinnear's true motive for retreating to Summit House. "Oh, stop it," he told himself. "First, you're probably doing Willis a profound disservice, even considering the possibility that he's been conspiring with Teigman. Secondly, even if he is, Teigman obviously didn't object to your coming up here. So either he doesn't know about your little secret, or else he doesn't see how it could have any bearing on the current situation." Despite the seriousness of the moment, Kinnear snorted in dry amusement. From Teigman's reaction to his decision to spend several days up at Summit House, the intendant had clearly decided exactly what Kinnear had hoped he would decide, that having the archbishop safely tucked away in an isolated vacation lodge, reached only by a single narrow road, little more than a trail really in many places, suited the Inquisition's needs perfectly. There was no way Kinnear could possibly sneak back down from Summit House and creep through Terrace without Teigman's knowledge. All of which, Kinnear thought, was quite true and completely irrelevant to his own plans, such as they were and what there was of them at any rate. Knuckles rapped on his bedchamber door, scarcely audible over the storm howl raging about Summit House, and Kinnear turned from the window as the door opened.
"It's time, Your Eminence," Fraidman Thomas said, and held out the heavy parka.